are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, March 2nd, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, historian Stephen Frazier. On our age of acquiescence. Also on the program today, Bibi Netanyahu at AIPAC.
We're okay. It's not that big a deal.
And tomorrow he will be speaking in the U.S. House and supposedly to a joint session of Congress. It remains to be seen how many people show up. Also on the program today, Friday, in a late night session, Boehner finally gets the votes to kick the can 7 days down the road. They cannot figure out how they're going to do this. Question is as to whether Boehner will still be Speaker of the House. Here's why I think he will be. No one else wants the job. Also on the program today, Barbara Mikulski, Senator from Maryland, retiring Democrat. Good timing for those who want to see Democrats take over, take back the Senate, I should say, because more than likely that seat will be filled by a Democrat. And finally, also, Tamir Rice, you'll remember the 12-year-old who was shot to death by a police officer in Cleveland because he was outside playing with a toy gun. City has found that, of course, that shooting was his fault because he didn't exercise due care that a 12-year-old should when outside playing around with a toy gun. Unbelievable. Folks, I am moments away from heading down to Washington, D.C. I'll be located across the street from the Supreme Court, hopefully talking to people who have been inside, who get a sense of the oral arguments in the King versus Burwell case. I mean, we've covered it many times. So if you head over to the site, you just Google search King v. Burwell. You will hear three or four at least interviews of it. But I'll be providing more coverage tomorrow. I'm going to be doing a lot of pre-taping. Hopefully I'll have a couple of good guests lined up for when we're live as well. But all in all, I will be down there for the next 2 days. The programming schedule will go as normal, more or less. I have a feeling Freebies may end up getting a little bit more. But if that's the case, then so be it. In the meantime, I will be heading down there. I'll be back on Thursday. And Matt and Michael will do the funner half of this program. A couple of things. I just saw we got an IM asking to discuss the Australian study about bus riders and privilege. Maybe I'll talk about that tomorrow if I have time or Wednesday. I will bring that stuff down with me. But certainly we will get to it. Also, want to remind you, there are many ways to support this program. We are going to be starting within days now. We're very close to launching our Indiegogo campaign. But in the meantime, good news, the Majority Report was nominated for Best Politics News in the Podcast Awards. We didn't get into the People's Choice. There's too many big boys up there, although Best of the Left did. So that's good. But I wanted Politics News anyways. So let's focus on that one, folks. You can vote every day, I believe it is. Is that the way it is? You can vote every day, at least once a day.
Starting?
Right now.
No, starting tomorrow.
Oh, tomorrow. Well, that's annoying.
Well, just remember, when you're some people might be listening to this podcast, and the voting may be open. What? So if it is March 3rd, where you are as you're listening to this podcast, go to podcastawards.com.
Yeah, folks, really need your help on this. This is oddly very important to me personally. But also, I think it helps the show. I mean, how else will we get letters, cease and desist letters from patent trolls, if not this? So head over to Politics News. The other people on that list, No Agenda with Adam Curry. Right. No Agenda. Common Sense. Right. Of course. It's all common sense. Congressional Dish. Not familiar with that one. The Bubble Genius. Really? Are they really a genius? I don't know. I haven't listened to it. Slate Political Gab Fest. Mm-mm. Best of the Left.
You can vote for us in Politics and News and then vote for Best of the Left in People's Choice.
There you go. Bingo. Cognitive Dissonance. I don't know. I have never listened to it, but it's definitely a term I learned in junior high. So, Democracy Now, great show. Don't need a podcast award.
They get enough awards for
right.
other things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Rachel Maddow Show, it's not even a podcast. It's a TV show that puts out a podcast.
So Come on. It's that simple.
Right. So head over there tomorrow. All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back. Steve Frazier. The Age of Acquiescence. Back on the Majority Report on the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome to the program historian Stephen Frazier. His latest book is The Age of Acquiescence. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me on.
So as I just mentioned to you when I rang you, you know, this is a question that we have been asking quite a bit on this program over the years and have been noting in the context of the amazing wealth and income inequality, this sort of second gilded age that we're living in, that you call it. But you, in your book, you basically say there's a double mystery. And
speaking generally, you say, why do people submit for such an extended period of time to exploitation, oppression, and domination? And then equally mysterious, you say, is why do they stop doing that? And with that sort of framing, let's first start with the first Gilded Age. Tell us about the circumstances of that age and the resistance of that age.
Right. I think what is most remarkably different about our two Gilded Ages, and that's the premise of my book, is that the first one was characterized by massive and multifaceted resistance to a very similar predicament, that is to say, the maldistribution, almost outrageous maldistribution of wealth and income, but not only of wealth and income, but also of power. Power then, wealth and income then, were highly skewed in favor of what today we would call the 1%. But what all happened then and has not happened now in the last generation is people rose up in a variety of ways. There was a populist movement that swept across agricultural rural America, both on the Great Plains and in the South. There were labor movements of various kinds, the Knights of Labor, for example, and the American Federation of Labor. There were radical movements of all kinds, socialist movements, anarchist movements. There was a vast anti-monopoly movement that embraced millions of people all across America. And all of these movements were not only training their wrath on the income inequality and wealth maldistribution, but also on the way that threatened the democratic heritage of the country. The Senate back then was known, it could be known today, and was back then known as the Millionaires Club. The judiciary was seen as a creature of the wealthy classes in America. Industrialists were, or what they used to call robber barons, were likened to aristocrats who were undermining the democratic achievements of the American Revolution. And these movements were accompanied by a broad cultural persuasion that there was something fundamentally wrong with capitalism, that it was producing all kinds of, you know, sweatshop labor, great material deprivation, inequalities of various kinds, and that the whole system needed to be either changed root and branch or fundamentally reformed. And people talked about the cooperative commonwealth or about socialism or whatever, public ownership. This was the lingua franca of our ancestors. And everybody saw, everybody joined those movements, but everybody recognized, even those on top, that this was the nature of a very deeply divided class society, one people likened to two nations. That was a common phrase then. And people even then talked about, just years after the Great Civil War had ended, people were anticipating a second Civil War, this time between the haves and the have-nots. Well, if you compare that kind of atmosphere, that kind of organizational mass movement to our own recent 25, 30-year experience of inequality, they're incomparable. We accept capitalism as a fate, given the horizon of possibility for those even opposed to our maldistribution of wealth doesn't extend beyond capitalism. There's nothing like the mass movements of those days. The labor movement is a pale shadow of what it once was, even as recently as the 1960s. So that is the most striking difference. You know, people are fond of, and they're right, of saying, gee, we're living in a second Gilded Age. It's just like the first. Well, yes, but also no. It's really not. And my book is trying to figure out why that's the case.
And I want to talk about the differences, but I want to go back and talk about, like, exactly when we're talking about, when we talk about that first Gilded Age.
Sure.
Because, you know, one thing that strikes me, I mean, because, you know, we're talking about two different things here. We're talking, or I should say, in terms of what people were responding to during that first Gilded Age. One is the sort of the plutonomy, and one is the plutocracy, right? The wealth and income in unbalance, which led to an imbalance in political power.
Exactly.
And so when did that happen? And it's also, it's funny to me too that we're, you know, we're talking about maybe the late 1800s and the early 1900s, and going back to a heritage which, you know, wasn't I mean, I think the perspective, and maybe this is a, this is something we talk about, in, and I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but the idea of appealing to a heritage which was still in some ways, in many respects, I mean, you know, we'd just gone through a civil war, I guess less time had passed by the time we hit the first Gilded Age from the Civil War than basically now to, you know, the mid-60s.
Oh, and I blink. The Civil War ended in 1865. By the mid-1870s, when the country was in a Great Depression, already the movements I have referred to were afoot. Already there was talk about the Paris Commune coming to America. Already class warfare, class struggle was a commonplace of our language, and that's just a decade, not even a decade after the first the Civil War itself had ended. Yeah, we're talking about the late 19th, what I call the long 19th century, which runs all the way through the New Deal, FDR's New Deal. And that, one way of looking at how things were then and how they are not now is to compare what presidents then were entirely comfortable with talking about. For example, Theodore Roosevelt talked about the malefactors of great wealth and said, you know, I'm not in awe of these titans of industry and financial tycoons. Yeah, they've made money and they've been good at what they're doing, but I don't admire them as statesmen, as savants, as heroes. I'd rather admire scientists and explorers and creators. Now, our heroes, and this has been true for the last 25 years, are kind of Wall Street guys, you know, who made $1 trillion, and we worship at that altar. So here's Theodore Woodrow Wilson, when he ran for the presidency in 1912, ran mainly on a platform condemning what was then commonly known as the money trust, and that was all the Wall Street white shoe investment banks and law firms and insurance companies, which he and many others accused of so heavily concentrating the wealth of the country, the capital of the country, that it was hard for smaller businesses and so on to compete, and also using that wealth to undermine our democracy. He used that notion of a money trust quite freely because he knew a broad population of the country understood the country that way. Or, of course, the most famous example is FDR himself, who in the 30s feels entirely comfortable with talking about economic royalists, Tories of industry, the way they manipulate, quote, other people's money. And when he runs for his second term in office, just near the end of his 1936 campaign, he says, in effect, this is a paraphrase, although the last part of it is a quote, that he knows that the rich and powerful hate him, and he says, I welcome their hatred. Can you imagine any president since, say, Harry Truman saying anything remotely like that today? And that is testimony to the way our language, and language is very important, has been cleansed. You know, we talk about ethnic cleansing. This is linguistic cleansing. We strip our vocabulary bare of exactly the kinds of words and metaphors that we need to confront this kind of dichotomy of wealth and power.
And I want to talk about whether or not the notions, the language is has been stripped because the sort of the impetus has been stripped in some way. And we should also note, of course, FDR, and we actually have that quote in one of our rotating openings of this program. that FDR, of course, was of that ilk. I mean, these were his people.
He was very much a
class traitor, I guess, in that sense.
Accused of being a class traitor. So was Teddy Roosevelt. But J.P. Morgan once said about Teddy Roosevelt, this is after he had just left his presidency and went off to Africa on a safari, he said, I hope he meets a lion and the lion does his duty.
Right. And what the irony is about this is that we're talking about a time where theoretically, right, the access that the average person has to this rhetoric that is coming out of these politicians would theoretically be less, right? I mean, we don't have the same communication mechanism. We don't have a 24-hour news network where these things would be ballyhooed over and over again. I mean, I guess to a certain extent, you know, it sets the tenor more because these are the comments that that resonate, and people just have a sort of a one dimensional notion of these people. But let's also talk about, I mean, or if you could just give us a sense of, we have a sense of what we're hearing from our politicians, but it seems to me too that the reservoir of ideas that existed at that time relative to capitalism, maybe not so much democracy in some fashion, because we have so many immigrants coming from particularly in Europe, where we see sort of these nascent other sort of, I guess, at least economic systems, or at least right. Talk of these other economic systems. I mean, where was the wellspring of these things coming from?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I think you're right that the cultural reservoir was ocean deep. And the reason it was that deep and embraced not only working people and farmers and others who were suffering these oppressions and exploitations, but all kinds of intellectuals, poets, novelists, journalists, this kind of anti-capitalist persuasion. And I think the reason for that, that the cultural reservoir was so deep, is that many these populations were the first to experience the full-blown impact of industrial capitalism. And moreover, they were shocked by it. And not only were they shocked by it, it contradicted earlier ways of life, which all of them either had directly come from, which were non-capitalist, or had relatives, had ancestors who had come from those. They were peasants, as you pointed out, say from Eastern and Southern Europe. They were handicraftsmen. They were small storekeepers. They were farmers, independent farmers. In other words, they had known ways of life. They knew that capitalism was not, they didn't accept that capitalism was the only way to organize society because they knew that was not the case. They, in fact, had come from other ways of life and where the moral domination of the marketplace as the only value that matters, you know, that the dollar and nothing but the dollar matter, that contradicted whole forms of, many of them were maintained, they were not dependent. They hadn't become yet proletarians or what our ancestors were entirely comfortable with calling wage slaves. They had their own means of support. And so this gave them a vision. And there's a lot of reasons for acquiescence today. But if I had to point to one, that's it. It's the lack of vision, which these people had as their birthright, because they were not only were they shocked by capitalism and its relentlessness, but they knew something else, and they knew and they felt themselves going out of existence. That is to say, not as humans, but as independent farmers, as petty storekeepers, and so on. And they didn't want to. Who would?
So if I understand you correctly, it's not just a question that they had come from other places and so that they had the ability to conceive of a different type of organizing principle for their economies, but also I would imagine there was a whole raft of values that had nothing necessarily to do with, or at least maybe from their perspective, economics, but had to do with just sort of like lifestyle and morals and basic values that were threatened or they perceived could be threatened by capitalism.
Yes, exactly. To cite just one, equality, which of course has been a watchword of American culture forever, meant something different then than it did today. Equality didn't imply this kind of, here's a phrase that even our current president uses, a race to the top. Equality didn't mean then, let me see how I can become unequal, meaning how do I outdo my neighbor, my competitor. It didn't imply a kind of relentless, ruthless competitiveness. Instead, it meant a competency, equal to others with enough to get by, live decently, live in a civilized way, but not to be always climbing. That's an example of a kind of value which infused the notion of equality then, which the modern competitive marketplace has slowly, or not so slowly, eviscerated. And it means now it's something that's very divisive. I got to outdo my neighbor.
So is it more an equality of outcome versus opportunity? I mean, because that's sort of how it breaks down, right? Is that
That's right. Okay. And rarely in our country have we been able, as a dominant philosophy, to think about equality of outcome as what makes us a more civilized place. Instead, it's strictly, like I say, an equality of opportunity to become unequal, to race to the top. Who gets there first?
So if we are talking that as early as 10 years after the Civil War, I mean, in the course of Reconstruction, we're already seeing sort of these competing notions of or at least sort of, I guess, nascent competing notions to capitalism. And we're just, I guess, beginning to enter into the industrial age at that point. Or I guess we're not entering into it, but we're in full swing at this point.
Right.
How much, you know, and when we compare it to the Gilded Age of today, which seems to be, at least when we talk about in the making, it seems to be, 45 years old, let's say. I mean, let's just peg 1970, because in many respects, somewhere around there, I would imagine. Is part of the problem that we're just not, it hasn't been going on long enough, or is it that?
Well, I think part of the problem, if I may interrupt for a moment, I think part of the problem is another difference between these two Gilded Ages. Ours, the one we've been living through for however many years one wants to pin it, is based not on the industrial upbuilding of the country, but rather on its financialization, the transformation of an industrial into a financially driven economy. And that has come at an enormous social cost. And one of the major, it meant deindustrialization. And deindustrialization is not merely an economic matter. It has wiped out whole ways of life. Whole towns have gone out of existence, essentially. Towns, whole cities. Look at Detroit. And what that means is that all the institutions that common people, ordinary people, built up to defend themselves, to make a civilized life, most importantly the labor movement, which grew up with that industrial development in the late 19th and into the mid-20th century, it was eviscerated. So that the actual material capability to resist has diminished. You know, the labor movement when it grew in the 1930s, say, wasn't simply a movement for better wages and hours. It was a movement for human dignity. It was a movement for human freedom. It was a movement that actually stood before the country not only in defense of its membership, who might belong, say, to the auto workers, but for all working people. It was the main force advocating social welfare of various kinds, low-cost public housing, health insurance, you name it. Well, when you go through deindustrialization and that movement begins to shrink, when the political parties begin, especially the Democratic Party, well, no one expected the Republican Party to defend it, but the Democratic Party used to be the home for the labor movement. It turned its back on the labor movement and began it was won over to the neoliberalism, which became the bipartisan persuasion of both major parties, and the labor movement and the world it had helped to sustain died, and with it the capacity to resist.
It's interesting too, because I wonder if when you move from deindustrialization to financialization, and one thing that has come up as a common theme when I've talked to people who have written about sort of those people most hurt in the 2008 recession, and most acutely hurt, that there is this notion of isolation, that they do not see their impoverishment or their difficulties as part of a whole, but rather it's almost as if they've made a personal mistake. And in some ways, by moving from a deindustrialized to a more financialized economy, that ethos is there, right? Like if you haven't saved your money or if you haven't made the right investment, you lose. It's like you didn't buy your lottery ticket at the right time.
Exactly right. And it's there in another way, which is a product of financialization, and that is debt. And what I mean by that, we all are quite aware, of course, of how deeply in debt and disastrously deeply in debt Americans became over the last 25 years, and that all came home to roost during the Great Recession. But what is debt? Not only is it a way for the major financial institutions to, as we know, with their collateralized debt obligations and so on, to make out like bandits, right? The rest of us are struggling. Debt also becomes a form, for as long as you can sustain it, of private liberation. Okay, you have a problem. Let's say it's a material problem. Can't send your kid to school, right? Or you can't buy the essentials you need to live a kind of, you know, comfortable middle-class life. What do? Do you join the labor movement and say, let's redivide the wealth of this country? No, you go into debt. You go into debt, and the debt's there, and the debt's there because the financial institutions want it to be there. But for you, it becomes a form of private emancipation until it all collapses on you. So it kind of militates against social emancipation, collective resistance.
And it, I guess in some levels, too, it also provides sort of like the it's the frog in the sort of the slowly burning, boiling water at that point.
Right, right, exactly.
You don't realize just how in trouble you are until it's a little bit
really
it's too
collapse.
Late.
Right, yeah, until it's too late, right.
And, I mean, so, I mean, talk about that that dynamic there, too, the sort of the and I wonder if that goes hand in hand with this notion of fear in terms of
–
It
does indeed. Because I don't want people to think, listening to me today, that all I'm talking about, although it's very important, is the way our values have changed and our belief systems have changed that has made acquiescence commonplace. It's also fear, the politics of fear. And that haunts us in many ways. Debt, of course, does. That puts the fear of God into you because you're going to lose this, you're going to lose your home, you're going to lose whatever, and you want to hunker down and do what's expected of you. But there are various other kinds of fear. You know, we have 30 to 40 million people who are the working poor. They work and they live in poverty. That's exactly what the first Gilded Age was like. We during the prosperous mid-20th century, we stopped thinking about poverty as associated with work. We began to think of it as a result of being excluded from work. Say you lived in Appalachia or you lived in a black ghetto and you didn't have work. But in our second Gilded Age, we now have this enormous population of the working poor. Well, who are they? They're people scared to death. Why shouldn't they be? That's why I ask, you know, why do people ever resist? It's scary. They might lose their job. Their employer threatens to move abroad, or he does move abroad, right? Or he brings in replacement workers should they dare to strike and there's no real NLRB to protect them anymore. He says, you better take this wage concession or you're going to be out of work. I'm going to cut all your fringe benefits. I'm going to essentially deep six your pension plan. And if you don't agree to that, I'm gone. So this is fearful. And if you're an immigrant, oh my gosh! I mean, if you're one of the millions of undocumented immigrants working like a devil to sustain at a very low level your family, are you gonna raise your head and say, hey, enough of this? You, my employer, are violating every wage and hour law on the book, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Most of the time, you're not. You got too much at stake. That's why it's a kind of miracle when people do, as they did, say, in the 1930s or they did in the 1890s, say, despite that risk to life and livelihood, I'm going to nonetheless resist.
I mean, do you think it's a function that there's just enough, that we're not quite as a society, or it's harder to reach that critical mass of nothing left to lose? I mean,
I don't think so. I think it's a very popular idea that uprisings happen when people are desperate and they're at their wit's end in a material sense. I don't actually think that's true. There's only been one revolution in America. Well, I guess you could say the Civil War was a second. But if we think about our own American Revolution, do you know that actually the American colonies, economically speaking, were faring quite well? Very well. It was an affluent colonial situation. They didn't like getting taxed for this and that without being represented in Parliament, sure, but that's a political issue. They weren't bothered by their economic circumstances. For many Americans, they were quite, and yet they committed an act of revolution. And again in American history, it's not really that.
But that's a political revolution, right? I mean, that's not an economic one.
Yes, that's true, but it's a pretty serious one when you're actually overthrowing the most powerful empire in the world at that time. That's actually governed and controlled that for nearly 300 years, that's quite an act. So, yes, it is political, but in the end, that's what revolutions are. And the movements, for instance, you know, there are periods in America. I'll give you another example of what I mean. If you took the depths of the Great Depression is more or less, say, 1932. Mm-hmm. Things never got quite as bad as that. It's horrible. And if you took a snapshot of the country right then, you would see a deeply demoralized, despairing, inert population. Very little was going on, and they were at rock bottom. If you took that same snapshot 2 years later in 1934, say, or thereabouts, when the economy had begun to pick up thanks to some of the early New Deal recovery measures, you see an entirely different country. General strikes in San Francisco and Minneapolis, a nationwide textile strike, sit-ins in the auto industry and the rubber industry, sit-down strikes in every conceivable industrial sector, farmer labor party springing up in the Midwest, and so on and so on and so on. And yet that was a period when the economic gloom had begun to lift. And sometimes that helps because people are encouraged that there may be some better future ahead. So I don't think there's a one-to-one correlation between the badder things get, the more likely revolution is.
If I remember correctly, when I learned about I can't recall the book, but quite established a theory on why revolutions took place, particularly in Latin America, was when actually sort of the grip was somewhat loosened just a little bit. Where are we in this respect? I mean, you mentioned Occupy Wall Street in there, and I think one thing that in my mind happened with Occupy Wall Street. I mean, there may have been some internal issues about maintaining its momentum, but there was a tremendous amount of arguably repressive response by a coordinated police departments, you know, coordinated by the federal government, at least to some extent, across the country, that quashed this before there was sort of
you're absolutely right. I mean, this is another aspect of the politics of fear, which conduces to acquiescence. We live, you know, the Cold War was when the national security state really first came into being in the immediate years after World War II, and all the essential apparatus of a surveillance state began to develop, the CIA, et cetera, and so forth. And, of course, it's also the period of red witch-hunting communists domestically in America. And that's when you have the origins of the politics of fear. I'll tell you something. The architects of that surveillance state back in 1950 would be amazed if they were around today to see what the government is now capable of in terms of repression, surveillance, and so on. And Occupy Wall Street is a small example of that. And there's surveillance every place. It's not just government surveillance. It's corporate surveillance. Look at they count your keystrokes at work. You need to urinate. They're watching. You know what I mean? In other words, there's electronic surveillance across all of workplace America. Forget about political America. Has become a commonplace. This instills a kind of atmosphere of fear, to be corny about it, that Big Brother is watching,
concern is that Big Brother's not necessarily going to disappear you in this country, but it's going to make your economic prospects that much worse.
That's right.
Steve Frazier, author of Age of Acquiescence, I appreciate your time so much. Thanks again.
I enjoyed this very much. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Say something. Welcome back, folks.
We're back. We will take a quick break, and we will go into the Matt and Mike fun half today. Sam is headed towards where's he
DC.
Headed to? DC. Oh yeah, he's headed towards DC. Yes, of course. So we will take a quick break. Again, you know how to become a member. Majority.fm. Click become a member. You can also support this show by buying all your Amazon junk through MajorityReportKickback.com. You will notice no difference. You'll buy all your stuff, same price, same selection, except Amazon's forced to give us a little bit of a kickback. Also, JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee and chocolates. Use coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off your entire order. We'll be back in just a few minutes for a Matt and Mike Better Half. Sam will see you all live from D.C. tomorrow and Wednesday, and then he's back in the studio on Thursday.
Where's the phone?
Set an apple pie.